Have you read a good book lately? Tremendous Life Books is the premier publisher of motivational and inspirational books, and we're located right here in Mechanicsburg. Looking to improve your ability to interact with others at home, in business, your ministry, or community? The staff at Tremendous Life Books invite you to find something that motivates you to be a lifelong reader and leader. Visit us today at our showroom on West Allen Street in Mechanicsburg or online at www.tremendouslifebooks.com.
Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome, everybody, to Tremendous Life Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's an honor and a pleasure to introduce a returning guest tonight, Ms. B.J. Gallagher. B.J. is a dynamic workshop leader, keynote speaker, and an acclaimed author. Her award-winning book, A Peacock in the Land of Penguins, is celebrating its 20th anniversary edition, and it's been translated into at least 21 languages to date. BJ, welcome back to Tremendous Life Radio.
Oh, thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, man, it's really our pleasure. You know, the first time you were here was quite a while ago, and I got so wrapped up into listening to your story that we really didn't get to talk about any of the books, so I don't know what will happen tonight, but I had a blast. You know, you're so wise, and it's just really, we're really grateful and honored that you came back to share with us.
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't know how wise I am, but I'm always happy to share my my experience, strength, and hope with people. And one of my favorite sayings is, you know, if you can't be a good example, you'll just have to serve as a horrible warning.
Yeah,
and sometimes that's true. You know, it's like, don't do what I did.
Well, hey, let's. Can you give us a digested version? I mean, you know, I believe you're on the West Coast. You've probably been on the West Coast most of your life. You went to college there. What was it like growing up as a young lady? I mean, take us back a little bit to kind of what shaped you.
Well, I'm actually an Air Force kid, so I did not grow up in California. Mm-hmm. I'm a native. I was born in Orange, but we left the state, I guess, well, I think I must have been about seven, I think. My dad got transferred to the Armed Forces War College at Norfolk, Virginia, which was my first experience of living in the South. So we lived there for 6 months and then took off to Germany and spent 4.5 years there and then came back. And I did 3 years of high school in Illinois. But before I ever even started school, when I was little, we lived in the Philippines, in Japan, Great Falls, Montana, briefly. I don't remember any of those because that was before the age of five. So I'm a military brat who, as the wisdom goes, I'm at home nowhere and I'm at home everywhere. Mm. But I always knew California was the place. It was my home, and so I've been back here now, I think about 40 plus years, and probably won't leave, you know. This is home.
Yeah. Hey, well, thank you for that. What was it like? I mean, when you were just telling me that, I mean, obviously it's a blessing to be able to look back. I'm guessing if you're anything like me, we don't always know the value of where we are and what's going on at the time. But looking back at those early years and being able to see the world in a lot of diverse, I mean, do you think that plays a role in how you were shaped and who you are today?
Definitely. Definitely. There's a wonderful book I read some years ago, must have been 20 years ago, called Military Brats, The Legacy of a Childhood Lived in the Fortress. And that book helped me understand myself so much because there are certain common characteristics of military kids, whether your parent was in the Navy or the Marines or the Army or the Air Force, there's certain common characteristics. And one is often a tremendous sense of loneliness, because you're moving all the time and you never you're never in one place long enough to feel like you really belong. But there's some upsides too. I mean, for me, one of the upsides was I learned how to move into a new situation quickly, sort of figure out the social situation, you know, how's the game being played, who are the popular kids, you know, and then play the game and the friendship game, the social game, and then move on in a couple of years. And so I learned really good observational skills, like how to understand people and what they were up to, which has served me in great stead as a writer, because I'm most comfortable when I'm on the margins, when I'm not fully in a group, but I'm not outside the group either. I'm sort of on the edges. And so I often feel like an anthropologist who's sort of studying a group of people, even if the people are my own family. And so I really got very good observational skills and very good people skills, because in order to survive, military kids, even the shy ones, often develop something they call forced extroversion, that you're forced to become an extrovert even if you're not naturally one, just to survive, because you're moving all the time and your survival really depends on being able to make friends pretty quickly and get along with new teachers and new kids at school and that sort of thing. So, you know, like any upbringing, I'm sure growing up in a small town has its blessings and it has its handicaps. And growing up as a military kid, sort of this gypsy lifestyle, had its blessings, and it had its, you know, its downside too.
Well, and that's interesting. Thank you for that. You know, I don't have any real questions prepared ahead of time, so the show's always perfect in my mind because it free flows. So, but that, when you mentioned that, it made me think, where did you fall out on the introvert extrovert? You know, looking back, were you naturally pretty outgoing, or were you kind of shy?
I think I was naturally outgoing, although, you know, somebody asked me about 20 years ago, I was at a professional meeting, and a colleague said, BJ, are you an introvert or an extrovert? And I said, well, why do you ask? And he said, well, I always thought you were an extrovert because you're talkative and you're energetic and you're charismatic. And, you know, I always think of you as a people person, but you write all these books. You know, I've written and published 30 books in the last 20 years. And he said, you're writing all these books, and that's a solitary enterprise. So now I'm confused. I don't know if you're an introvert or an extrovert. And I looked at him, I said, I'm an ambivert. I go both ways.
Hey,
and it's true. And I think as a child, that was true as well, that I really enjoy my alone. I was an only child for the first 8 years of my life. So I like my quiet time. I like my alone time. I'm used to solitude. I enjoy my own company. And then when I'm with people, I love that too. I get energized, I get talkative, I get excited. So I think that would describe me. And maybe I would have been that way even if I'd grown up in one place. Or maybe that military upbringing was a big part of it. Who knows, nature versus nurture? Who knows? But I'm happy being the way I am. I live alone. I work alone. I write a lot of books. But then I also go out and I do seminars and I do radio interviews and I have friends and great neighbors and I socialize with people. So I kind of go back and forth between both worlds.
And it's interesting. I may be wrong, and our friend Don Miguel Ruiz says don't make assumptions, but I assume from watching you in social media, reading books, that you seem to be, and maybe you've been labeled this before, I'm not sure, a kind of a free spirit, You probably have heard that before. I'm guessing you have. Maybe
yes,
I'm incorrect.
Some people,
that's
a kind term. Some people would call me a loose cannon.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get to that part. But no, and the reason I say that is I find that so so refreshing. I guess the word today is authentic, or you know. But it certainly sounds, even what you just described about working alone, and that you're right with yourself. That's a attraction piece, I think, in itself that speaks volumes, just in the way people speak or carry themselves. And I've never even been in your presence, and I feel that way about you. So,
thank you.
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's even a compliment. It's just the way I feel about it, and I may be wrong. But you know, that's that attraction piece. We hear a lot of speakers, and we read a lot of books and authors talking about leadership and all those things. But you know, for me. And it's all good, but for me, I think it's based mainly, you know, on attraction. And I don't have to go home with all those authors and see how they live, and maybe they do live free. But you just exude that kind of freedom. And I see your funky car and your flowery stuff and, you know, lots of color in your life and very, very colorful. And so I just find that super good. And I don't know how you write a ton of books like that, and the books you write are... Someone wrote it, simple, straightforward, and effective. I like those words, you know, just like the title of the book, The Power of Positive Doing. Now, I'm getting caught up in doing a lot of talking here, and I typically don't do that. I like to listen. So that's what really, I've been, you know, watching you for years and following and reading. So take us through those after you were traveling. And I don't know how we get the label Brad either, but that would be a different show. But
It's a traditional name. People outside the military community often think it's a negative connotation, but I think of it as a term of affection. That it's sort of that military kids are sort of spunky. Just to survive, you have to be kind of spunky and resilient. And a little independent-minded, and of course, some of us, because we grew up in the military, we have a defiance about authority.
That'd be a whole other show, too, BJ.
That's a whole other show. But you know, one of the favorite things my mother, I used to say to my mother when I was a teenager, sometimes was like, "You can't tell me what to do." And then, of course, when I became an adult, she turned it back on me, and now I'm her caregiver. And she doesn't say it anymore, but up until a few years ago, she would turn to me. I'd say, "Okay, Mom, now eat your lunch." And she'd go, "You can't tell me what to do."
That's good. Hey.
goodness.
Yeah, thank you for that.
That's
a great story, too. Really, it is. It all comes full circle.
Yeah, and I think the authenticity you speak of, part of that is my generation. You know, I'm a boomer, and I was born in 49, so I'm one of the early boomers. But we baby boomers and children of the 60s really value authenticity and really don't like pretense. That said, it took me a long time to really get comfortable in my skin, because part of that, having to make new friends all the time, it can easily lead to people pleasing and being a chameleon. And I think I was a chameleon for many, 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 many years, and trying to figure out what it was that people wanted from me and then be that. Because I desperately wanted to be liked. I wanted to be appreciated and accepted. And it took me a long time to sort of drop the chameleon act and just show up with whatever was happening, whether I was sad or depressed or upset or happy, or to really be authentic. Even when I was always authentic when good stuff was going on, but if there was something bad going on, I'd often hide it.
Yeah.
And, you know, cause I wanted to be liked.
Yeah.
And now I don't, and maybe it's age too. I'm 65 now. So when you get into your 60s, you sort of go, gosh, not only don't I care what people think about me anymore, what I've discovered is they weren't thinking about me at all. So freedom that comes with that when you realize nobody's watching, nobody's paying attention. Yeah. So you might as well just have fun and live your life. And as long as you don't hurt anybody or do anything dangerous, nobody's watching.
Hey, well, take us through that. So you went to college for in Southern California, right?
Yes and no. I did my first 2 years at the University of Delaware. I kind of did things backwards. I graduated from high school, and I got married within 6 months. So I got married when I was 18. I went to high school in Illinois, came to California, picked out a good-looking fraternity man and said, "You're the one." And married him in my freshman year, and he was still in college, too. We were really crazy. Mm-hmm. And that was the fall after the summer of love. It was 1967. So I sort of blame that on the Doors, you know, "Come on, baby, light my fire," and the Santa Ana winds and too much beer. So got married, had a baby right away. Married life was really miserable. And so I only stayed with him about 3.5 years and then didn't know where to go. So I went back to live with my parents, and by then they were living in Delaware. You know, home is wherever dad is stationed. So I lived in Delaware for a year and was a cocktail waitress and trying to figure out what the heck am I going to do with my life. I was a 22-year-old cocktail waitress with a 3-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And like, what am I going to do? Now I have no college, no husband, no whatever. And so I did go to school, but I didn't start college until I was 23 and my son was 4, because I knew I didn't want to be a cocktail waitress the rest of my life. I at least wanted to have options. Being a cocktail waitress is fun in your 20s, but somehow I didn't think it would be fun when I was in my 40s. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to have options, I should go to school. And so events conspired. I got a scholarship to go to school. So I did 2 years at the University of Delaware and then was ready to come back to California, and so transferred out to USC and have been back in California ever since. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I did an internship in Washington, D.C. the summer of 1974, and that's when Richard Nixon was president and they were going to impeach him. Mm-hmm. And so I got an internship in a Republican congressman's office, the congressman from Delaware, and so that was a great experience too. And I just took my kid along for the ride, so he had sort of an interesting upbringing too, with me as his free spirit mother, as you said.
Hey, was there some take us through this if you can? Were there some defining moments through that period? Looking back, can you identify? I mean, did you have any kind of burning desire? Were you writing at the time? Did you have a song in your heart? Can you recognize any of that? Or was it kind of pretty much just, like you said, the universe conspiring?
I didn't start writing until the 1980s. I had no inclination to be a writer. I really liked going to school. I liked going to college. As I tell my friends sometimes, when I was a little girl, school was my favorite game. And all these years later, it still is. I mean, but if I can't make a living going to school, I'll do something in that field, like I'll write books or I'll teach workshops. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So I really thought I might be a professor. I was a liberal arts student. I was getting a degree in the social sciences, so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. During that internship, I thought, maybe I'll stay in Washington and work in politics, because that was really exciting, particularly at that time with Nixon and the whole thing. That was, historic. Mm-hmm. But then I decided I really didn't like politics all that much, so I changed majors to sociology to learn about people. and came back to California, finished my degree, jumped right into a PhD program, spent 3 years doing that, and that PhD program was in social ethics, which is in the School of Religion. So I was, by then I was on a spiritual journey to really understand God and the good life and right and wrong and good and bad, and I was really interested in those, the big questions, like what's the meaning of life? And so that's where my academic studies took me, and that's really how I ended up writing my very first book, which you know, you probably don't even know about. It was published in 85. I had been teaching a 2-week summer class at USC called Psychological Development Through Autobiography, and somebody asked me if I would teach that class at the Bel Air Presbyterian Church. So I did, but I changed it to spiritual development through life history writing. And I started teaching that class at various churches in the Los Angeles area and really loved it. And it was, I say it's like one half pop psychology, one half pop religion. And it was designed to help people write their stories and through the process, come to understand themselves better, perhaps deepen their relationship with God, tie up any loose ends or finish any unfinished business, let go of old baggage, that writing is a really therapeutic process. And then I forget whether it's my idea or somebody's idea, but I decided to write a book based on that class. I've been teaching the class for about 11 years, and I certainly had enough material, so I put together a proposal and started looking for a publisher, and my very first book was published in 85. It was called Telling Your Story, Exploring Your Faith, and it was published by a little Christian publishing house out of St. Louis, Chalice Press. And that was my first book, and then I didn't write again for 10 years. People would say, well, when are you going to write another book? And I said, well, I don't have anything else to say. You know, I put it all in the book. I'm done. And, you know, it wasn't until 10 years later that I had something to say again. Wrote another book.
That's like 29 books later, you know, you're still writing. So that's a
It's really cool to hear that, though.
It's really cool to hear you describe that. So we all have a story and we all have something to say, probably, or some of us do anyway. I just was so interested in, I mean, you seem so creative and so free and right with yourself. And you led into that, the spiritual aspect. I mean, did you know, well, I guess you didn't, you waited 10 more years. What was going on inside of you then? Did you have like was there a calling? Do you sit still in the morning? Was there a voice speaking to you saying you need to go bring value to people and help them get right with themselves? Or did none of those things happen?
You mean with the second book?
Well, what you were doing for those 10 years, what was going on inside of you? Were you?
Oh, I was busy. I was raising my son. Let's see, in 84. How old was he? I'm trying to think. He was born in 68. Oh, I guess he was kind of old, wasn't he? He was a teenager. Anyway, well, I was working. I had a full-time job, and I was still raising my son. Yeah, he must have been a teenager at the time, and I was commuting, and in Los Angeles, that can take up a lot of time. And I just didn't have anything to say. The first book was really motivated out of a desire to take this course material. It wasn't a personal book at all. There wasn't anything of me in there, or not much of me in there. And it was really like a class. The second book 10 years later was much more personal, and that was A Peacock in the Land of Penguins. And that one I wrote after I left the Los Angeles Times. I'd gone from USC to the LA Times. I spent 4.5 years working for the LA Times, and when I left, I was hurt, I was angry, I was filled with resentment, and I felt like I'd been treated very badly. It was that old line about, I gave them the best years of my life, and this is how they treat me.
Mm-hmm.
And that they, I took on the job of change agent, and I saw my job at the time, I was the training manager, I saw my job as comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And I got that line from a pastor of mine at that time. And
which one were you better?
Yeah, that's what I do for a living. I comfort the afflicted and I afflict the comfortable.
I like it.
Yeah, you're welcome to use it. It's a great line. And
well, hey, which one were you better at?
Oh, I was really good at both, but
okay.
Comforting the afflicted won me lots of points with the rank and file.
Yeah.
But afflicting the comfortable, you know, really annoyed a few of the executives. And you don't have to annoy too many executives before they go, you know what? We're annoyed. You need to leave.
Yeah. Well,
I was still pretty young. You know, I was still relatively naive about organizational life and that sort of thing. So anyway, 6 months after I left the Times, and I can't complain, the newspaper business was great. It was interesting. I learned a lot. They gave me a big pot of money to go away and not bother them anymore. And so that was a real blessing. I thought, this was God opening the door going, you know, come on out. You're going to be self-employed. You're going to write books and you're going to teach seminars. And I'm going, really, God? That's what you, really? And there I was. And I started to write the story really as a mental health exercise just to get it out of my system, thinking if I write it down, then I can move on.
Yeah.
Because after 6 months, I was still angry. And since I know the cathartic value of writing, I thought, okay, I'll write it down. And then the story got longer. It turned into a book. And then a friend said, oh, you should talk to my literary agent. And the next thing you know, it was a book, and it got sold, and it was successful, and we made a video, and it really transformed my business. And I look back now and I owe the LA Times a great debt of thanks.
I was just
because
thinking
if, exactly. Because if I hadn't had that experience, I wouldn't have a story to tell.
Yeah, that's wild.
I would never have written a book. You know, the book is published in almost 24 languages. And the other thing I discovered after I left was, I made it personal, and it wasn't personal. The executives there were really doing what they thought was in the best interest of their company, and I made it. It felt personal that that I couldn't be a more effective change agent. So literally, I was the peacock, and they were the penguins. And they kept saying, oh, we love your work. Why don't you put on a penguin suit?
Yeah.
And I go, no, I don't do penguin suits. Anyway, but the whole thing just turned out great in that, you know, my editor told me at the time, and I love this, he said, when we were editing them, he said, don't edit your book by the numbers. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he goes, well, don't say like, well, 6 people out of 10 said I need to change this part of the story, or 7 people out of 9 said I need to do that. You know, take all the feedback you're getting and test it against your own experience, your own intuitive heart. Because, and here's the key, that which is the most personal is also the most universal. And so in telling my story, I just disguised everybody as birds, but in telling my story, people all around the world could hear the ring of truth to it because it was their story too. And I've gotten mail from people all over the world going, thank you for telling my story. So it turns out there are peacocks and hawks and owls and doves and jaybirds all over the world who feel misunderstood, like they don't fit in. They're criticized for being, quote, different, and they struggle with that. And so, you know, there's a wonderful book by Henry Nouwen called The Wounded Healer. And in it, he says, it is through our own wounds that we are able to help other people heal. And that's what the Peacock book is for me, in sharing my wounds of working with people who didn't understand me, who wanted me to conform, who wanted me to be just like everybody else. In sharing that pain of that, I was able to tell a story that other people would go, I have that same wound. I have that same pain. And now that I know I'm not alone, I feel better.
Wow. You know, that's, BJ, thank you. It's awesome to listen to you tell that story. I heard you tell me that before. It's just so amazing to me, so cool that, you know, what started off really, like you said, was a big ball of resentment and hurt, you know, became the catalyst for you writing so many really positive, valuable, useful, helpful books. You know, I mean, and you didn't know, you obviously didn't know it at the time, right? I don't think you did.
No, I didn't. I had something to say. I was going to write one more book.
Talk about the universe conspiring. You know what I mean? It's wild. And, you know, what you're describing, I reflect on my own life. Like, I rarely ever know what's on the other side of anything as I'm moving through life.
Yeah. And I remember crying and praying to God when I was there at the Times, like, why have you deserted me? Why have you left me in this terrible place? I'm so miserable. Oh, God, where are you? Where are you? And I was right where I was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know it at the time, that I had to go through that experience so I'd have something to give to other people. And a little sidebar to that, a few years later, maybe it was just 2 or 3 years later, I ended up going back to talk to several of the LA Times, to my bosses there, to make amends. Mm-hmm. Because what I realized was, when I wrote the book, I really turned them into the bad guys. Yeah. You know, the Penguins were stupid and short-sighted and narrow-minded, and they couldn't fly and they had no vision, and I was a little heavy-handed with the Penguins, and I realized that, oh, I made them wrong, and they weren't wrong at all. They're good people. Mm-hmm. They just had a different take on what their organization needed than what I thought they needed. So it's not that I was the virtuous one and they were jerks. It's that we were all good people with different perspectives on what the newspaper needed at the time. But they were certainly surprised to hear from me a few years later when I said, you know, I'm really sorry for being so difficult. I was wrong. Yeah. I was wrong. But it was a really good lesson for me, both as a human being and as a consultant, that I have to allow others the dignity of their own choices. Mm-hmm. And that means for a company, they have the right to run their company right into the ground, mm-hmm. if that's what they choose. And it is not my job to save them, rescue them, control them, and certainly not to save them in spite of themselves. And so it really helped me professionally. It helped me overcome my codependency of wanting to rescue, fix, and save people. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I either have to change professions or I have to come from a different place where I can be a resource to you, but you have to do the work, you know? And you have a right not to take my advice. You have a right to do whatever you want to. And it made me a better parent. It made me a better friend. It made me a better consultant. That, you know, to let other people, like I said, to allow them the dignity of their own choices. And my job is just to love them. And if they ask for my help, I will help them. But not to force my help on people who don't ask for it.
You know, as I'm listening to you, BJ, it's really wild how God works in my life. You know, I'm in that place almost right now. Like, I want to be careful about this in my professional life. And just hearing you say all those things, I see it, you know, like, and I'm looking at the mirror with the peacock looking back at me on your website, and it's exactly where I am. So you didn't know at the time those things, though. That's the trap as well as the gift, right? Like, you didn't know that you were personalizing. It's hard, right, to get out of that and let people be, especially if they're paying you to be a change agent, you know, and then I can justify the whole thing. So it took you writing the book and maybe years of mail and speaking about it to kind of come to terms with that and see your own place, right? I don't want to wait that long, you know?
If I were to go there now, mm-hmm. I think I could work with them and let them be who they were and, you know, help them to the extent that they want my help. But I couldn't do it at the time that I had a vested interest in. I just so needed them to see it my way.
Yeah.
I so needed them to wise up. But that was my codependency, you know. I was uncomfortable because I could see them driving down the wrong road. I could see them making one bad decision after another. And I'm screaming at them, wake up, wake up, wake up. Don't you see what's happening with the internet? Don't you see what's happening with the Orange County Register? Don't you? And the truth is they couldn't because they were too deeply embedded in their own paradigm, their own worldview. And to them, I just look like a lunatic. Really, I wasn't joking when I said loose cannon. That's what they thought of me, like, oh God, what's she up to now? I was trying to save them. See, before I went to the LA Times, I used to just date alcoholic men and try to save them.
Yeah, right.
And then I walked into the LA Times, and it was like walking into a drunk's house going, Jesus Christ, you guys, boy, do you need me, and single-handedly tried to save the whole company from itself, 12,000 employees, and I was going to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, when I woke up and it was reading the power, talk about the power of books, I read Melody Beattie's Codependent No More.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I had to laugh at myself. I went, wow, are you arrogant? You think you're not content with just saving one alcoholic man. You want to save a whole company from itself when they never asked you to.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, my God, I've been really foolish. But, you know, that was a lesson I had to learn both in my professional life and my personal life is to let people make their own decisions, let them make their lives. If they ask for my help, I'm happy to help them. But ultimately, it's their life. And some people only learn by making with painful experiences. There's a wonderful quote by Mark Twain that I love. He says, a man who carries a cat by the tail learns lessons he can learn no other way.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
And I'm screaming, don't pick up that cat. Don't pick up that cat. And they're going, what's the matter with you? This cat's fine. And, you know, they ended up in bankruptcy. I ended up leaving the company. And, you know, they're still not in good shape. But that's not my business. That's not
business. It's wild when you're telling this story, those stories. We had Melody on the show a couple of times. And I bought the book, Codependent No More. I knew she was coming up on the show. And also because I'm surrounded, this is how my mind works. I'm surrounded by all these needy people. So I bought the book. It came from Amazon. It was in the box. And I went to my step and I got it. And I opened the box right there at the front door. And the title in big letters says Codependent No More. And the subtitle says Stop Controlling Other People. And I thought, I got busted. I thought, oh, my God. I've got it. Oh my God. And a guest on the show that was from a guy from Texas in the Al-Anon program, he said when he found out about my past a little bit, he said one time, it was a very kind thing. He said, "Oh man, Todd, you're a 2-time winner." Because I have it, yeah. And I thought, man, I don't know, it didn't seem that good to me, you know. But even you describing those lessons you're learning, and then the value of sharing that's where all your wisdom, or a large part of it, came from, correct? Your own?
It came from mistakes.
Yeah,
I had to do it all wrong before I could learn how to do it right.
Yeah, that's cool, though.
And I look back, I mean, I look at my life now and I think, let's see, I messed up my marriage, I was a crappy parent, I've been in jail, I got a DUI, I've done this, I've had a bankruptcy, I've done da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I go right back to the wounded healer. Mm-hmm. And right, if I had led the perfect life and been little Miss Goody Two Shoes, and been, I was a straight A student, but if I'd been a straight A student in every aspect of life, I wouldn't have anything to give, and mm-hmm. I'd probably be really arrogant, because I wouldn't understand why other people can't do it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So in sharing all my mistakes, all my failures, all of my oops. That other people go, oh yeah, me too, me
yeah.
too, and that's really where we meet, is in our, you know, we are all deeply flawed creatures, and it's in our flaws, that's where our character is, that's where our humanity is, that's where surrender comes from, because if we could run our lives ourselves, we would. Because we tried it for a long time and it didn't work very well.
You know, that's it. And you keep showing up after that and you keep sharing that. And that's, I guess you've written so many positive, inspirational books. I guess that's because you messed up more than some other people.
Oh, man. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And when I mess up, I generally mess up big time.
I said that.
So
more
I share that and it helps people. Because, you know, I mean, the whole 12-step community is founded on this. Therapy is founded on this. That it's in the process of identification when I can say, you know, boy, look how I messed up there. Look at how badly I did that. Look at how badly I did that. And yet it all turned out okay. And then people go, oh, yeah, I can too.
Yeah, and that's the hope piece, and also, you know, the experience shot. So, and most of us still, you know, and you talked about it earlier, from my own experience and understanding, most of us can listen to other people's, and I don't even like the word mistake as much as opportunity, and we still do it ourselves anyway. It's the way we learn typically, and it's just, I think that's human nature. Maybe you agree, maybe you don't, that
yeah,
most of us
yeah.
learn. I mean, I can read a lot of books. My father has Alzheimer's right now. You can read about all those things, you can study it, but until you're living in it, you know, you really don't know what you're doing, and you don't know what you're doing when you're living in it either. So,
but it's kind of nice. One of the things that studying Buddhism, which I did before I wrote Being Buddha at Work, it gave me an excuse to learn about Buddhism because I wanted to write about it, was Buddha really taught the value of not knowing. Mm. He called it beginner's mind. And that if we show up with the expert's mind, we're not teachable. There's a wonderful Buddhist parable about this professor who goes over to Asia to meet the Zen master and to learn from him. And he's so excited, and they sit down together to have tea. And you may have heard this story before, I don't know, but I just love it. And so he's starting to pour the tea, and the American professor is going on and on and on about how much he knows about Zen Buddhism and this and this and this. And then the Zen master is pouring the tea and pouring the tea, and pretty quickly the cup fills up, and then it starts overflowing. He keeps pouring. And it's the tea is going everywhere. And all of a sudden, the professor stops, and he looks and he goes, my God, what are you doing? And he goes, well, you see, this teacup is like your mind. If your mind is already full, I can't add anything. It just flows over. You need to come to me with an empty mind, an empty teacup. You know, to know nothing is a virtue. And I love that notion of beginner's mind, because I too, my mother has Alzheimer's. And I come to it with, I didn't read any books on Alzheimer's. I just show up for my mother. I show up with an open heart and an open mind and a desire to serve her and to walk her through this last part of her life. And several people have said, oh, you know, are you gathering material for a book? Are you going to write a book? And I go, nope. Nope. This is, I've written lots of books about lots of things, but I just want to live this. I don't want to be an expert. I just want to live this. I want to have this experience with my elderly mother. I want to be there in her mind and her heart. And I just want to experience it, because it's a different process to try to put things on paper than it is to just live it. I mean, maybe someday I'll write about it, but I don't think so. I think it's like carrying a camera around with you all the time trying to capture pictures, and you can be so busy trying to capture pictures that you miss the experience of being there. So, you know, I don't travel with a camera for the same reason. I just want to have the experience, you know, just be fully present to whatever is going on, and
well,
then
and, you know,
just experience it.
Well, BJ, listening to you describe that, you may not have, I guess you're right where you're supposed to be too, because you may not have been able to do that, maybe even not so many years ago. You know, wherever you are in your life and with your own experiences,
right,
and whatever's going on, that's what's cool to listen to that, you know. But that, isn't that also when we're in those things, if we're really not aware of what's going on, or reflect back onto all the gifts that are lessons that we've learned, you know, maybe we miss those opportunities. So it's a constant. I don't want to be walking around in eggshells, though, all the time, trying to be so aware of every single word and every single feeling that I miss everything, too. You described it with the camera.
Yeah.
So, but you've had a number of years to learn these lessons and to fall down and get back up again. You know, and I just think it's such a blessing that you share it all so openly with
thank you.
Probably just about anybody that asks, I would guess.
That's my job. I have two gifts, and one is teaching and one is writing. And my job is to give them away. And so it's just as simple as that whatever I have learned, somebody taught it to me, or life taught it to me, and my job is to pass it on. I think I may have told you the last time we talked, you know, Mother Teresa had this lovely saying. She said, I'm a pencil in the hand of a loving God. And so I adapted that just a little bit, and I say, I'm a laptop in the hands of a loving God.
My job
is to just take whatever. Well, I'm the messenger. I am not the message. I'm the scribe. I'm the channel. I'm the pipeline. And my job is to just funnel that stuff. And if it helps somebody, that's great. So I don't write for myself. I write for other people. And I don't teach for myself. I teach for other people. And, you know, I just want to contribute what I have, so that when I die, I'll be all used up, you know, all spent and just nothing left. I gave it all away.
Yeah. Hey, even listening to you describe that, though, it seems like it started out writing about that you needed to write about your own pain, and that was a penguin, peacock in the land of penguins. So it's cool the way things change. You know, motives change, desires change, purpose changes, and you've kind of showed up the entire time to sort through it all, right?
Yeah, I have. And my mother used to ask me, she'd say, well, when are you going to write your life story? I said, well, I'm not going to write my life story, because probably you and my son would be the only two people who'd want to read it. But I said, but there's bits of my life story in everything I write.
Yes.
So if you want to know about my life, you can just gather them all up and pull out the pieces. But, you know, I just weave in experiences, thoughts, lessons that people have taught me, You know, it's all there. It's just not in one volume. And I think it's more helpful that way, you know, to share little pieces with people where it's appropriate rather than say, well, I was born here and then this happened and that happened. And, you know, I don't think I'll ever do that. But it's all out there for anybody who wants to, you know, who wants to know the stuff that's happened to me and the things I learned from it and the lessons I learned and the lessons I'm still learning. Oh, my goodness. I think, you know, does it ever end? Probably not. Do those, quote, mistakes ever end? Nah, I make them every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
And so do I. And I chuckle, too, most of the time, you know. And it is. It's really opportunity. Opportunities abound in my life, I'll tell you. You know, there's so much opportunity for me to learn. And I probably block a lot of it because my cup is full lots of times. Usually because I'm running my mouth is running usually. You know, a mentor of mine years ago, I was working with him. He was working with me probably for 2 or 3 years. And he asked me a question one time and I said, man, I don't know. And he jumped up and celebrated. He said, hallelujah. It's yes, we can do it. All right, now we can begin. You know, and that made me mad, you know. But I see today, you know, what you were talking about. And I have that, you know, the block. I know stuff. So, and sometimes knowing stuff really gets in the way. You know, and you've been describing this the whole time. I have this written down, and your story seems to describe this. I guess you're a believer that a certain level of disturbance inside of us is really, really a gift, right?
Yeah, it is. You know, I just last week I was feeling really funky, really just out of, it's like something's not right. And I'm old enough now that I've learned it's inside, that it's not, a couple years ago I came across this great, it's a Zen quote, I don't know who said it, but it said, the obstacle is the journey. And I saw that because the thing I have struggled with the most in my life is food, is my weight. And ever since like junior high school, it's always, I'm fat. And of course there's enormous pressure on girls and women to be slender and beautiful. And I was at one point, but even when I was, I didn't know it. I still thought I was fat because it's a perception thing. And I have struggled with this, you know, with food and my weight for so many decades. And I was really looking at it last week going, the obstacle is the journey. Okay, this is a gift. And obviously this is this crazy relationship I have with, I always say there's never met a carbohydrate I didn't like. And, you know, this crazy relationship I have with food, particularly carbs, I think that's obviously the work I need to be doing now. You know, just that it's not something to be conquered or to run away from. It's there to, it's my teacher. That this eating disorder is my teacher. And it's here to teach me something. And I just don't know what that is. But my work now, just like my work is to be with my mother and be her companion, my work with myself, my soul work, has to do with this lifelong love-hate relationship with food, because there's something there for me to get. And all the running away and all the, you know, the trying to diet and this and that didn't get me anywhere. And I think, okay, just be still and, you know, talk to this craving. Buddha talks a lot about craving and desire. Pay attention to this craving and see what it's trying to tell you. What are you really hungry for? What are you really thirsty for? What's the emptiness in your soul, you know, that makes you want to go eat half a loaf of bread and butter? You know, that's your soul work right now. So don't run from it. To pay attention to it. And, you know, I feel so much better now that I'm paying attention to it and remembering that the obstacle is the journey.
Wow. Hey, that's, Well, thank you for sharing that, BJ. Really, thank you. I mean, it's really intimate. You talk about things. You definitely are transparent is the word, correct? I mean, you know, well, I mean, it's so, I mean, it's refreshing. I mean, it just really is, you know. I mean, again, we've never met in person and you just talk to me and I learn from that and I value that. So thank you.
One of the things that us food addicts or us carbohydrate addicts know is that our addiction, we can't hide it. You know, it's there on our hips. It's if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or a gambling addict, you may be able to cover that up for a long time, but if you've got a disordered relationship, if food is your drug of choice, you can't hide it. It's there. It's just there for all the world to see.
PJ, the best website for the listeners and everybody to follow you and get to know you and get the books and do everything is bjgallagher.com. Is that correct?
That's it. It's just short and simple. They can also find my books on Amazon and hopefully some of the more recent ones in their local bookstores as well. But they can certainly find me on at bjgallagher.com. They can find me on Facebook. They can find me on Twitter and Huffington Post. I write regularly for Huffington Post. So if they want to get little samples of my writing, they can go there too.
I got to say, you know, thank you. You're like a breath of fresh air. You just really are. You know, I mean, what you talk about is just positive, actionable, get over yourself, keep your feet moving or get them moving kind of stuff, you know, that is valuable. It's just valuable. I mean, I guess the value comes to mainly people that are a little disturbed. You know, I mean, maybe people that are just perfect and just feel light and fluffy 100% of the time. Maybe a book like The Power of Positive Doing wouldn't sound attractive to them, or Why Don't I Do the Things I Know Are Good for Me? Maybe they already know that and do all those things, but I don't believe that for a second. Your books are huge value to anybody, all the books. And I haven't read all of them, but I am a committed believer in that you bring much to the table. I mean, you just really do. And, like, you're cool, too, so that doesn't hurt You're just like...
Well, I believe that pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth, that unless we're in pain, we don't move. We don't change. We don't grow. And Anais Nin said it really well. When you know, the pain of staying closed up in the bud becomes worse than the pain of changing, then we open up. Then we blossom. And, you know, for most of us, it's pain that makes us go out and buy a book. It's pain that makes us go to a 12-step meeting. It's pain that makes us seek out a therapist. It's pain that drives our change. So rather than try to run from the pain, if we can welcome the pain and say, what are you here to teach me? Mm-hmm. You know, what do I have to learn from you? And to embrace the pain as our teacher.
Well, and it's refreshing to hear that. That's the mission of the show, Tremendous Life Radio, and that's what we really try to do is hopefully be a little proactive, bring people with messages like yours. You know, I know it sounds a little bit fluffy almost, because typically no one changes anything unless they really see there's a need to change. So, you know, but hopefully the message gets out there. We don't know who we reach really, and we just hope we reach somebody. I'm sure we reach some people tonight. You certainly reach deep into me, BJ. Thank you so much for sharing your experience.
You for the platform. I really appreciate it. And, you know, if something I shared has helped you and helped your listeners, that's my job.
You did good.
That's my job.
You did
just
good,
doing my
BJ.
Job.
You did good. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. God bless.
Have a lot of fun. See ya. There you have it, Miss BJ Gallagher. You can find out all about her at bjgallagher.com. She really is a beautiful person inside and out. I completely believe that. BJ Gallagher at bjgallagher.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Really was a great, powerful show for me. I hope it was for you as well. Get over to the website, tremendousliferadio.com. You can listen to our archives there. We have hundreds of guests, a lot of wisdom, a lot of life experience, a lot of actionable situations from a lot of real positive people. tremendousliferadio.com. You can search iTunes, just search Tremendous Life Radio. We really appreciate all the listeners. We certainly appreciate all the guests. We couldn't do it without either. We got some great guests coming up in the next couple of months. Check them out. Stop in. If you like us, share us around. Tell people about us. If you don't, tell people about us anyway. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until next time, make it a great day.